This is the EMDocs.net podcast with Britt Long and Manny Singh. We bring you high-yield content about what you're seeing every day in the ED. Today we're going to do something different. We're going to talk about a disease course, spinal epidural abscess, and then in the second half of the podcast, we're going to dive into some pearls and pitfalls. Let's get started with some basics. Spinal epidural abscess is a pyogenic infection of the spine confined within the epidural space between the dura mater and the vertebral periosteum. Unfortunately, cases are actually rising. There are now about 10 cases per 10,000 admissions. There are several reasons for this. First is the older age of our population. Second is the increasing rate of spinal surgeries. Third is the increasing rate of immunocompromising conditions. And fourth is the more readily available imaging modalities that we need for diagnosis. The mean age is around 50 years, but most cases occur between the ages of 30 to 70 years. The big problem with this is the morbidity. Unfortunately, severe neurologic disability occurs in up to 22% of patients, and less than half of patients return to their baseline neurologic status after therapy. Mortality can even reach 20%. The most common cause of infection is entry into the epidural space from a contiguous infection, like a psoas muscle abscess, a skin infection, or osteomyelitis. The other causes include bloodstream infection or direct inoculation. The infection starts as a focal pyogenic infection that involves the vertebral disc or the junction between the vertebral body and the disc. The infection then spreads longitudinally in the epidural space. The most common site affected is the thoracic spine, followed by the lumbar and the cervical regions. The reason why the thoracic epidural space is most commonly affected is this is larger and it contains more fatty tissue, which makes it more prone to infection. Infection usually affects 3 to 5 vertebral spaces, and it's usually monomicrobial. The most common bacteria is Staphylococcus aureus, which accounts for anywhere between 60 to 90% of cases. Gram-negative bacilli account for about 20% of cases. Most patients present with nonspecific symptoms like back pain or flu-like symptoms. The problem with this is that this means that this condition is a challenging diagnosis, with about 90% of patients initially misdiagnosed in the ED, and the median number of ED visits before a diagnosis is made is around 2. This delay increases the risk of residual neurologic deficits. Let's get into the presentation. First, you need to look for risk factors that increase the risk of bacteremia, things like injection drug use, hemodialysis, alcoholism, diabetes, renal or liver disease. You also need to look for recent spinal instrumentation, trauma, and then also a contiguous skin or soft tissue infection, because this significantly increases the risk of spinal epidural abscess. Back pain by far is the most common presenting symptom, but it might be indolent and non-focal for weeks, followed by severe localized pain associated with neurologic findings. Progression can vary, and the disease may evolve rapidly over days. There are several stages. The first stage includes back pain at the affected site. The second is nerve root pain from the affected spinal cord level. The third includes neurologic changes like weakness, asymmetry change, or bowel bladder dysfunction. And the final stage involves paralysis. Fever can occur, but most commonly in the initial stage. Your evaluation may include a CBC, inflammatory markers, and also blood cultures. The key diagnostic modality is going to be an MRI of the whole spine with and without contrast. CT with IV contrast can help in looking for the bony integrity of the spinal column and the presence of fluid collections, but it does not have 100% sensitivity or specificity. You may have heard of CT myelogram. This used to be used, but it's invasive, it can spread the infection to the subarachnoid space, and it's really no longer commonly utilized. There are a couple keys for management here. First is reducing the size of the spinal epidural abscess and the spinal cord compression through source control and eliminating that causative organism. Treatment is going to involve antibiotics in all cases and some form of surgical intervention in most cases. Up front, if you have the diagnosis or if you're concerned, speak with your spinal surgery specialist and the infectious disease specialist. In most cases, surgical intervention should be performed within 24 hours of diagnosis because this will improve patient prognosis. That's the first part with the basics of the disease. Let's get into some pearls and pitfalls. The first pearl and pitfall includes the risk factors. There are a lot of different risk factors associated with the development of spinal epidural abscess, but the problem with this is that most of these risk factors come from retrospective studies or case reports and case series. Several studies show that there are approximately 50 different risk factors associated with development of spinal epidural abscess. So what does that leave us in the ED? The key is to look for three primary sources of spinal epidural abscess. Remember, we're looking for risk factors that increase the risk of bacteremia, recent spinal instrumentation, and then also contiguous infection. Diabetes is the most commonly associated comorbidity present in patients with spinal epidural abscess. Injection drug use is another common risk factor present in about 20 to 50% of cases. And then epidural catheter placement is also associated with spinal epidural abscess. I'll have a table in the show notes demonstrating all the different risk factors. Let's get to our next question, and that's the utility of the history and exam. Remember, the initial presentation is usually nonspecific. Patients may come in with fever, back pain, myalgias. This resembles many other conditions. That classic presentation of fever, back pain, and a neurologic deficit is rare. It occurs in less than 8% of patients. If it is present, the triad is highly specific for spinal epidural abscess. Some form of back pain is present in most patients. The duration ranges from 1 day to 9 months. Diffuse spinal tenderness is present in about 65%, and about 50% will have focal spinal tenderness. Fever is only present in about 50% of cases, so you can't use its absence to rule out the disease. A neurologic deficit can occur in close to half of patients, and it usually presents in later stages of the disease with severe spinal cord compression. This might include motor weakness, radiculopathy with sensory changes or pain, and then also bladder and bowel dysfunction. Unfortunately, once this neurologic deficit occurs, it's usually irreversible. Let's get to our third pearl. What about labs? A CBC might show an elevated white blood cell count in about 60 to 80% of patients, but you can't use a normal white blood cell count to exclude the diagnosis. Inflammatory markers like ESR and CRP might be helpful if they're used the right way. An ESR of over 20 is present in about 95% of cases, and CRP is elevated in almost all cases of spinal epidural abscess. But the problem with these assays is that they're both nonspecific, and if they're used inappropriately, it can lead you down the road to further workups that may not be needed. The other key lab are blood cultures. You want to obtain two sets of blood cultures from separate sites. Obtaining cultures from the infection site is also recommended to confirm diagnosis and assist with the antibiotic therapy. If the spinal specialist is going to perform surgical debridement, then they can obtain specimens then. However, if the surgery is going to be delayed or it's not going to be performed, then CT-guided aspiration might be used. Our fourth pearl is on imaging. The imaging modality of choice is MRI of the whole spine with and without gadolinium contrast. This has the highest sensitivity and can diagnose the infection early in the disease course and determine the infection location and the extent of the infection. Sensitivity and specificity are both above 90% for MRI with contrast. The key here, though, is that you want an MRI of the whole spine. Skip lesions or areas of non-contiguous abscesses can occur in up to 15% of cases. These lesions may not be associated with pain or tenderness, and if we miss them, it affects our therapy. Skip lesions are most commonly found in patients who have symptoms over a week, if they have a significantly elevated ESR of over 95, and if they have a concomitant infection outside the spinal or the paraspinal area. Now, let's be honest, MRI might not be available at all centers. We already talked a little bit about CT myelogram and that it's not really used anymore. CT with IV contrast can be used, but it can miss early signs of infection, and if you're going to go down this road, you need to speak with your spinal specialist. Okay, so we talked about labs, we talked about imaging. Who do you need to work up for a spinal epidural abscess? The key thing here is to use pretest probability. Not all patients with risk factors for a spinal epidural abscess need an MRI. If the patient has no risk factors, they don't have a fever, and they have a normal neurologic exam, they have a lower likelihood of spinal epidural abscess. The probability of spinal epidural abscess here is less than 1%. If you have a patient, they have a couple risk factors or they have a sensory deficit, then obtain inflammatory markers. If these are normal, then there's no need for further evaluation. The post-test probability is less than 1%. If inflammatory markers are abnormal, then you'll need to obtain imaging with MRI. If the patient has severe neurologic deficits, including motor weakness, and you're concerned about a spinal epidural abscess, then reach for MRI with and without contrast first. If this is not available, speak with your specialist and obtain a CT with IV contrast. The patient will likely require admission for an MRI. That brings us to our final point, and that's management. Management focuses on consultation with the spinal and ID specialists, administering antibiotics, and source control. All patients will need antibiotics, but if the patient is non-toxic, they're hemodynamically stable, then you can give antibiotics after you've obtained blood cultures. However, if the patient's in septic shock, they have severe neurologic symptoms, then hit them up front with antibiotics. You'll want to cover staph, strep, and gram-negative pathogens. Something like vancomycin plus ceftriaxone is a good starting antibiotic regimen. If you're thinking Pseudomonas could be present, then give them cefepime, ceftazidime, or meropenem in place of ceftriaxone. There are some patients who may need antibiotics and no surgical intervention. These patients are those with no risk factors for poor outcomes, they have a known infectious microbe, and they have no neurologic deficit. Keep in mind, though, that surgery is indicated in the majority of patients as early as possible, especially those with developing or worsening neurologic deficits, if they have an unstable spine, they're hemodynamically unstable, they're progressing while on antibiotic therapy, if they have involvement of five or more levels within the cervical or cervical thoracic spine, and finally, those with ring-enhancing lesions on imaging. Intervention within 24 hours is associated with the best outcomes. If the patient has been paralyzed for over 24 to 36 hours on initial presentation, they might be treated with antibiotics alone because they have a low likelihood of improvement with surgery. In summary, spinal epidural abscess is an infectious disease emergency. This can result in significant morbidity and even mortality. Unfortunately, it's often missed, and it's a challenging diagnosis. Factors associated with increased risk include immunocompromise, bacteremia, contiguous infection, and recent spinal instrumentation. Less than 8% of patients present with that classic triad of back pain, fever, and a neurologic deficit. Back pain by far is the most common presenting symptom, and up to 50% will have a neurologic abnormality. Labs might show a high white blood cell count, but a normal one can't be used to exclude the disease. Inflammatory markers do have high sensitivity, but they have low specificity. Obtain blood cultures, and the imaging modality of choice is an MRI of the whole spine with and without contrast. Management includes spinal specialist consultation and antibiotic therapy. Thanks for joining us on the podcast. Stay safe and healthy, everyone.